The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's Capital Thinking radio show. My name is Rebecca Carr. I'm filling in this week for Kevin, so that he can take a much-deserved summer break with his family. We've got a great show lined up for you today. Healthcare reform may have grabbed all the headlines lately, but Congress, when it returns, will also attempt to reshape the energy and financial services sector. A big job. We will examine that and the effort to use clean tech and renewable energy in the business sector. We'll take a look at how to secure project funding for clean tech from public and private sources. And with us today is a brain trust from the legal side of the mortgage industry. They will discuss congressional attempts to regulate the industry and what impact it has. So we're glad you've tuned in and hope that you will feel free to call in with questions at any point during the show. Here's the number to call in case you want to keep it handy, 866-472-5790. We'll start out with clean tech and renewable energies. Both of our panelists working closely with companies operating in the clean tech and renewable energy space, and they both are familiar with the processes and challenges these companies face as they attempt to access federal funding and as they engage in efforts to create more green jobs in Colorado and throughout the country. Carolyn McIntosh is a partner in the Denver office of Patton Boggs. She counsels clients on complex environmental compliance matters as well as environmental and natural resources litigation. With her is James Muchmore, an associate in the Denver office of Patton Boggs. He advises clients on corporate, transactional, and securities law matters, providing ongoing legal advice to publicly and privately held corporations. Let's start out by talking about how the Denver office of Patton Boggs has been involved in promoting clean tech and renewable energy businesses. Carolyn, can you answer the question about how the Denver office has been involved in promoting clean tech?
Good morning, Rebecca. Thank you.
Good morning.
The Denver Office of Patton Boggs is a founding member of an organization called Connected Organizations for Responsible Economies, or CORE, which is the Sustainability Trade Association in the Rocky Mountains. And its members include obviously sustainable businesses, those interested in developing sustainable practices, including clean tech and renewable energy business. We have just recently completed the first phase of a clean tech cluster analysis, which means that we've evaluated the clean tech companies in the Rocky Mountains and are beginning to segment them into different industrial sectors. But the interesting thing is we've identified over 700 companies in this sector in Colorado alone.
Wow, that's quite an astonishing figure. 700 companies in Colorado alone. What do you estimate across the country that figure would be?
Oh, boy. Probably millions, because it's definitely a developing sector. And it depends on how you define it, but can include biotech innovation, renewable energy innovation, nanotechnology, all the various suppliers to those sectors. So it's certainly a growing field in the United States and in the world, but one of the areas where the United States has an opportunity to regain some predominance in manufacturing in clean tech and renewable energy. And another activity that Denver is involved in, that our office is involved in, is educating business owners on how to get funding, and James can address that.
Yeah, thank you. Good morning, Carolyn. Good morning, Rebecca. Thanks very much. We're actually working with lots of private businesses, helping them access whether it be federal funding or private sources of funding. But also one of the things we're doing that's somewhat similar to our work with CORE and the clean tech sectors, we also work with an organization called the Smart Energy Living Alliance, which is an entity based here in Colorado that helps individuals and companies make smart energy decisions and helps them either implement processes at their workplace or processes really at home where they might be engaged in using energy that comes a little bit more from the renewable space or from the clean tech space. So fortunately, here in Colorado, there's a large support for use of renewable and clean tech energy, and Patton Boggs is at the forefront in terms of working to continue to develop that industry and develop resources for individuals as well as for entities who are looking to participate in that arena. So, also, something that we do as well is fortunately, with respect to funding opportunities over the last, I'd say, 6 to 9 months since President Obama was brought into office, we've been working with a lot of clients on how to, or providing them access or guidance with respect to applications for Department of Energy funding, Department of Energy grants, private capital, and other resources where they can get the funding and the support that they need to develop their technologies in renewable energy and in the clean tech sector. So I'd say overall here in Denver and in Colorado, we're really pushing hard and getting a lot of support from entities and from companies to develop the industry.
James, let me interrupt for a second. If I'm company XYZ, what advantage do I have by seeking clean tech and renewable energy changes in my company? What does it do for me as a company owner?
Well, there are obviously a number of benefits to accessing renewable energy and clean tech energy for a company. Number one, in terms of bottom line cost, you know, if an entity is able to use more renewable energy, then they potentially can reduce part of their operating costs that they would normally have to pay for traditional electricity or traditional oil and gas or traditional sources of energy that they use with respect to the operations and the running of their business, just turning the lights on in the morning. A second very tangible benefit is obviously since gas peaked about a year ago, in July 2008, at I believe around $4.50 or so, depending on where you are in the country, our country is much more focused now on reducing our dependence on foreign oil and using more domestic-based sources of energy. And that translates for a business into a positive perception and positive practices to their clients and customers, regardless of what industry they are in, such that a company can represent that they are engaging or using, rather, renewable energy and clean tech type energy and are taking that into consideration and have more of a macro understanding of where they fit in terms of the community and where they fit in terms of developing and a solution to our use of fossil fuels or other fuels that may not be the most positive, may not produce the most positive results on an environmental basis.
Yes, if I could interject.
Sure.
There are emission reduction benefits, air quality benefits derived from more focus on renewable energy and clean technologies, which, if their success in reducing greenhouse gas emissions, can have a positive impact on climate change.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like companies that are doing this are sort of on the vanguard of being green and thinking of being good corporate citizens in terms of embracing this new clean tech technology. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Carolyn, could you talk a little bit about the type of clients that you've been working with?
Well, focusing on that reduction of greenhouse gases, we've been representing a tire recycling company that has some new innovative technology that they will be employing to take used tires and chip them and process them down to a fine powder, almost to the size of talcum powder, which can then be reused in lieu of virgin rubber up to a 30% level into tires or any plastic products. And by reusing or recycling the tires, there are all kinds of air emission, waste management, and efficiency benefits derived.
That's fascinating. That really is. Now, is all the funding in the sector public money, or does it come from private sources as well?
There are actually a number of sources for entities to tap on the funding side. Obviously, the leader of the funding at this point is the federal government. Funding comes in the form of Department of Energy loan guarantees. It also comes in the form of cooperative agreements with the Department of Energy, which translates into grants pursuant to which companies can research and develop alternative sources of energy. And then there are also potential cash grants that entities operating in the renewable space or using different sources of energy can use from the federal government, so that if they are, for example, deriving a certain portion of their energy from a renewable source, there are cash grants that you can get from the government. But in addition to the federal funding that's available, there also are a number of private capital sources that are very interested in operating in this space. We found that both domestically as well as internationally, there's a large support system and a large amount of interest from private equity funds and other angel investors and other investment banks who are specifically interested in developing investment and sources of renewable and clean tech energy. So it's really on the federal level as well as on the private side, and we've seen positive responses from many of the folks that we've approached on behalf of clients operating in this space.
Okay. Well, it sounds like that. It sounds I'm getting cues from our engineers here that it's time for us to take a break. Carolyn and James, I want to thank you for taking the time to come on the show. We've certainly learned a lot, and we hope to touch base with you in the future on this topic because there's so much to discuss. So thank you very much for coming on board.
Great. Thank you, Rebecca.
Thank you.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
It's all about action.
Touchdown!
Scores.
Taking a look at the NBA tonight.
Highlights.
Oh, he's broken loose. He's at the 30.
And headlines.
Big trade in the NFL this afternoon.
When you are looking to talk sports, look no further than the Voice America Sports Network. We bring you some of the biggest names and all the sports news you can handle, whether it's basketball.
Off the glass.
Football.
Come on.
Boom. Golf, racing, or the Olympics. We've got you covered. We'll even cover tailgating. Tune in to the Voice America Sports Network. It's all things sports.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The house will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs, straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm Rebecca Carr. I'm filling in today for Kevin O'Neill, who's off on vacation, a much-deserved summer break with his family. Today, we have a special opportunity. We have three partners from Patton Boggs' fine mortgage practice group here to discuss the crisis enveloping the country from the industry perspective. While Congress debates how to regulate the mortgage industry, federal and state regulators are busy implementing and proposing new mortgage industry regulations. This constant change in regulatory requirements is proving to be daunting for the mortgage industry. Here to address those changes is Richard Andriano. He has over 25 years of experience and a thorough understanding of issues facing the financial services, mortgage banking, and consumer finance industries. He's frequently quoted in the media and often speaks about the mortgage industry. Accompanying him is John Stocknett. John uses his knowledge and breadth of the business issues affecting the residential and commercial mortgage industries and the legal landscape to advise clients on compliance and licensing matters under state and federal law. Michael Waldron is with us too. Michael helps clients navigate transactional, regulatory, and litigation matters facing the financial services and mortgage banking industries today. With an insider's perspective, Michael draws on his experience as in-house counsel to advise and represent mortgage companies. Let's start with you, Rich. Congress is considering the creation of a Consumer Financial Protection Agency and also substantive mortgage lending reforms. Has that caused existing regulators to stand down from rulemaking efforts?
Not at all. In fact, there are extensive rulemaking and implementation efforts that are ongoing. Some are at the direction of acts passed by Congress, but some are also self-generated by the agencies. In fact, you know, there are those who believe that the Fed actually accelerated rulemaking efforts under the Truth in Lending Act as a reaction to the criticism it was receiving that it did not act quick enough to address practices that contributed to the current state of the mortgage industry. So regulators are definitely not taking a wait and see. They are moving full ahead with regulations despite what Congress is considering.
How is that being perceived in the industry to have regulators cracking down like that?
One of the big criticisms, I think, from the industry is that while there's a lot of effort, it's not coordinated effort. And that is making compliance very difficult, trying to implement different pieces of regulations affecting the same business, but that hasn't been made uniform or conformed by the various regulators. So it's really proving to be quite daunting.
Mm. Now, John, turning to you, what are some of the key proposed pending or recent federal laws in the mortgage space?
Well, that's a very good question. There are of them, and Rich will speak to that, I think. But one that is I'm tracking very closely, and one that's really not on everyone's radar but should be, is something called the Secure and Fair Enforcement of Mortgage Licensing Act, referred to and commonly called the SAFE Act. And what's interesting about this act is that for the first time, loan officers, so individuals who work at mortgage companies who take applications and work directly with consumers, will be required to either be licensed or registered. And that applies regardless of whether you work for a state-chartered institution or for a national bank or a federally chartered thrift. For the first time, there are individual licensing or registration obligations that are going to apply across the industry. And that's something that particularly is a new regime for the depository institutions. They've never had to grapple with this. They have always enjoyed preemption over these types of laws, which exist and have existed at the state level for a very long time. And one element of this that's interesting, too, is that all of these loan officers are going to be required to register on the Nationwide Mortgage Licensing System, the NMLS, and each individual has a unique identifier or license number. And going forward, those numbers will have to be on all of the loan documents. So there will be an ability going forward for regulators and companies to look back over the course of history of the loan progression and track things like delinquencies, track performance, and will be an excellent tool for the industry, but also for companies to monitor quality of the loans that are being produced by their employees.
John, what does that mean for the little guy, the homeowner out there trying to get a loan? Is he or she going to feel the impact of these pending laws, or is it really mainly the banks and the mortgage servicers that are going to feel the impact?
Yeah, there really won't be a change or an impact. I don't think that the consumers are going to see an impact. The regulators, of course, think that ultimately this will result in better controls and better supervision of the individuals who are originating mortgage loans. For many consumers, buying a home is the most important financial decision they'll ever make. And the state regulators and the federal regulators believe it's important to have controls and monitoring of those individuals. So a direct impact, I don't think consumers are going to see the difference, but indirectly, it's certainly the intent that this is going to help better police the industry.
Now, Michael, given the complexities of the regulatory landscape, is the industry experiencing any increases in enforcement actions or litigation?
It is, Rebecca, and thank you for having us on. We are actually seeing an upward trend in both enforcement actions and litigation. On the enforcement action side, both state and federal regulators, as well as district attorney offices and state attorneys general offices, have been extremely active, which, given the depth of this crisis in the industry and the marketplace more generally, it's understandable. The perception of many is that the level that we're seeing reached with this crisis is due in large part to regulators not enforcing existing laws and, in fact, ignoring a whole host of red flags. So obviously, there's a lot of pressure on the regulators right now, and they are certainly being more proactive in their efforts to police the industry. While allegations of fraud, I think, tend to get the most coverage in this area, an area where we are seeing a very real increase in activity is with the Federal Trade Commission's actions against consumer financial services companies for deceptive advertising. Interestingly enough, the alleged violations being cited are not yet prohibited by the Truth in Lending Act, but the FTC, in again taking a more active role, bases its actions on its broad powers and its position that certain advertising practices are just simply unfair and deceptive. On the litigation front, we're also seeing an uptick. The bottom line here is the dust is beginning to settle, and people are evaluating the landscape and deciding who to pursue to help mitigate their losses and address their perceived wrongdoings. And that's both on a borrower front and on a business-to-business front. As you can imagine, there's been a dramatic increase in foreclosures, and therefore contested foreclosures is an area that we're seeing a very large uptick in litigation. That's when a borrower who's facing foreclosure sues a lender or a servicer, essentially alleging wrongdoing and therefore requesting a stay in the foreclosure proceeding.
How do you respond to the general pervasive sense out there in the marketplace that the banking industry, the banks who are servicing these loans, are not doing enough to help keep homeowners in their homes? Do you have a response to that?
I think, having been one that's been in and around the industry for a long time and having spent time in-house and knowing the industry folk, like our mortgage banking group knows them, I will tell you that the vast majority of folks are doing all that they can to run a compliant and solid operation and to help consumers remain in their house. At the end of the day, it's a common misperception to believe that originators or servicers want to take back homes and to own properties. That's not the business that they're in. They are in a business about liquidity. They're in a business to put borrowers into homes and to make loans, not to take those properties back.
Mm-hmm. Now, John.
And Rebecca, I'm sorry, I would just, if I could follow on to
that. Sure, of course.
One of the things that's quite interesting is that, we hear all of this from Congress, from the Obama administration, from the federal regulators, from the state regulators, imploring lenders and servicers to do more, to do loan modifications to help consumers. But at the same time, they are enacting laws, for example, the SAFE Act, which interestingly requires individuals who work at mortgage servicer shops who interact with consumers and engage and do loan modifications, they require those individuals to be licensed as loan officers under the NMLS. So at the same time that the administration is pushing and pushing and pushing, they're enacting laws, so one hand not talking to the other, that actually frustrate this process.
That is fascinating. Really interesting. Now John, how are the state regulatory agencies going to react to a single federal regulatory agency for consumer financial products?
Very good question. As it happens, I'm actually at the annual conference of the American Association of Residential Mortgage Regulators. It's the trade group for the state's mortgage banking regulatory agencies. And Patton Boggs is a member, and I'm actually on the advisory council to the board with other industry members. But this very issue has come up a number of times. And, the states always are very protective of their own turf. And any time that is threatened, whether it be in the form of a proposed federal law that will have uniform application or a single agency that might take or limit or restrict their ability to supervise or examine or enforce their own laws, they take it very seriously and they have concerns. One of the things they've done recently, I think in an attempt to stave off any sort of wiping out of the state's abilities to enforce these laws and regulate, is striving for uniformity. So they've enacted the SAFE Act, which was a federal proposed, the federal law, and then each state adopted its own version of it. So there's uniformity among each state as to who needs to be licensed. They've adopted this nationwide mortgage licensing system. They now are adopting multi-state examinations, again, pushing for uniformity in part for self-preservation so that they can continue to play a role.
Well, we're going to have to wrap up here. I've just got a signal that it's time to go to a break, but I wanted to thank you, Rich, John, and Michael, for coming on and explaining the mortgage mess to the American public. We hope to have you back on real soon because there's so many questions to ask, and we really appreciate your expertise here. Thank you.
The market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now toll free 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hola.
Konnichiwa.
Bonjour.
Hello.
From Anchorage to Abu Dhabi.
Markaba.
From Denver to Doha.
Ciao.
Patton Boggs makes business transactions the world over.
Oi.
Rely on our insights for your next deal. Patton Boggs, the international business team. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio. Voice America Business Network.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back. My name is Rebecca Carr, and I'm filling in for Kevin O'Neill this week so he can take a much-deserved summer break. And with us today is Todd Cranford, a consummate Washington politico, given his vast experience in Capitol Hill working for Congressman Barney Frank. You've heard that name recently, haven't you? The powerful chairman of the House Financial Services Committee. In addition to his tenure at the Securities and Exchange Commission. Todd Cranford draws from his extensive experience in the public sector with securities and financial services issues to assist clients on matters related to public policy, SEC enforcement, capital markets, and corporate governance. Mr. Cranford's government experience gives him an insider's knowledge that allows him to advance his clients' interests. So we welcome him here today, and we're thrilled to have him explain to us some of the impending regulations that are going to affect the financial services sector. Hi, Todd. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Rebecca. How are you?
I'm doing just great, thanks. So I thought we'd start with an overall landscape view from your perspective on where the administration is going. With it's forwarded a series of regulatory reform proposals to Congress over the past several months. I'm sort of interested for our viewers in seeing if you can dissect some of those proposals for them and provide a brief summary of what those proposals contain.
Yeah.
If it's ever possible to be brief about Congress, if you could possibly give us a sense of what those proposals have inside them.
Right, right, right. You're absolutely correct that the administration has, as it had intended to do, release a number of proposals that they have sent to Congress over the past several months. The first, and probably the most notable at the time, was the credit card legislation that was passed earlier this spring, which was noteworthy, I think, on a number of levels. Just the fact that it passed, before you even get to the substance of it, because the industry, the big banks and many of the smaller credit card companies had very successfully lobbied against the imposition of new regulations and rules for a long time. This was not the first time that credit card legislation had been contemplated, but it was the first time that it had gotten as far as to the president's desk for signature. And these new rules effectively, or at least purport to effectively, increase the number of disclosures that credit card companies must give and will regulate them more in terms of when they can actually change their policies, the types of notifications that must be given to consumers before they do so, and various opt-out provisions. All that was signed, as I said, a few months ago. Since then, we've had legislation or proposals coming from the administration sent over to Congress regarding executive compensation, and most recently the regulation of over-the-counter derivatives, which have been a thorn in the side of Congress because many on the Hill believe that, along with the fall in the mortgage market, that the lack of regulation or the under-regulation of the OTC derivatives market is directly related to the financial mess we find ourselves in right now.
Mm-hmm. Could you, for the lay people out there, such as myself, explain what over-the-counter derivatives really means? Well, how is the average person supposed to know what that means? Could you describe that a little bit more?
You know, there are many people smarter than I who still have difficulty with what exactly the definition of over-the-counter derivatives are. But essentially, derivatives are used as hedges by many companies to hedge against losses in their portfolios. And those hedges could be anything from, you know, the price of grain to the weather to very complicated arithmetic formulas that they come up with, that they have their mathematicians and engineers come up with. And I guess the problem or the concern that many people have had with them is that they fell into a gray area in the regulatory scheme. You've got the SEC, which is responsible for regulating equities and the bond markets, and you have the CFTC, Commodities Futures Trading Agency, which regulates commodities. And because these derivatives sometimes had components of both, it was not clear which agency, if either, had regulatory authority. And so part of the legislation that has just, or the legislative proposal that was just sent to Congress, aims to try to narrow those gaps, if not close them completely, by trying to assign either joint or several liability to the agencies. Prior to delivery of this proposal, there had been a lot of talk as to whether or not the CFTC and the SEC would be merged in some form or fashion. As you might expect, the regulators and many in the industry, the participants in the industry, were opposed to that for self-interested reasons as well as some pragmatic reasons about the impact on the markets that such a merger would have. Mm-hmm. And so I think the administration, you know, thought long and hard about it and decided that this, at least in the first instance, was the compromise that they were willing to put forth to be able to better regulate this market.
Interesting, really interesting. Well, now, Senator Charles Schumer, a leading voice on the financial policy and vice chair of the Joint Economic Committee, recently urged Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner to propose a single banking regulatory agency to, and dispense with all the alphabet soup of agencies that now oversee banks. This was met with support from some Republicans who liked the idea of one oversight agency for banks. From the outside, that seems to make a lot of sense. Get rid of the confusing oversight roles and streamline them into one. What are the chances of that happening, and what do you think about that proposal?
Well, there, you know, as with any proposal, there are pluses and minuses, and the National Bank supervisor that you're referring to is definitely, I think, on the table for consideration. There are some Democrats, and as you just pointed out, a number of Republicans who, at least initially, seem to be a little hesitant to go in that direction. They don't want any one entity to have that much power or authority or responsibility. There has been, as you're probably aware, a lot of talk about the systemic risk regulator that would be the overarching regulator responsible for determining what entities are, quote-unquote, systemically important to the economy, that would be, if they were to fail, would damage the economy to a point that would be harmful. And there are some, including Chairman Frank, who see the Fed as the natural existing entity, to take up that mantle. I think there is a lot of hesitancy to form a completely new federal government regulator, at least in this area, because of it's complicated and the time that it would take to get them up and running, and where would they get their personnel and expertise from. They would necessarily have to borrow from some of the existing agencies. But there are many others on the Hill, and I think in industry, that are fearful or skeptical is probably a better term, of the Fed taking on that role. The Fed.
Why is that, Todd? I mean, why are so many lawmakers on both sides of the aisle skeptical of the Fed? What does that come from?
Well, I think in the first instance, it goes back to the discussion you had a little earlier with the mortgage market and the mortgage crisis. The Fed did have some responsibility for regulating the mortgage industry, and they were seen as having failed at that by many policymakers. And there's a concern that this may be a little bit outside of their bailiwick in terms of being able to go in and actually review the books and records of so many of these companies that will be considered systemically important, the Tier 1, for example, companies in line with the proposal.
Okay. Hey, Todd, can I ask you to hold that thought?
Here in the music.
A quick break, and we'll come back. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to have Todd Cranford, the consummate Washington politico, back on after this short break. Thank you.
Markets up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Stewart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Stewart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back. Once again, we have Todd Cranford here with us. He's a Washington politico that kind of dusts the rest of the pack in his insight and his wit on what's going on Capitol Hill. And I thought we'd conclude this show with a summary of what's going to happen in Congress once they return from their August recess. As you all know, and you've probably been tuning in every day, there seems to be more debate on whether to overhaul healthcare, our nation's healthcare system, but also on the agenda is to find new ways to reshape the financial services sector. So with us today is Todd Cranford, who's going to make sense of that. Now, Todd, I was under the impression that the House wanted to act prior to the summer recess and that the Senate was holding off to the fall for the major reforms. Can you give us some timetable on what we can expect to happen once Congress returns?
Sure. I can definitely give you what my best guess is. And I think at this point, that's what most of us are doing, is just guessing. There are so many moving pieces going on right now. I think we are in an unprecedented period where you have several major reform efforts underway simultaneously. As you just mentioned, you've got health care reform. Not whether or not it should be done, but how it should be done. That seems to be the focal point of the debate now. You've got energy, which is still significant and on the table, and financial regulatory reform, which we've been discussing. You're right that initially both the President and Congress wanted and thought that they might be able to get something through at least the House before the August recess and then taken up by the Senate in the fall. But as is often the case when dealing with these issues and various constituencies, the House pushed back consideration of several pieces of this legislation, of the legislative proposals, except for executive compensation, which they took up right at the end of the session and actually voted it out of committee, took it to the floor, and now has passed a package that includes reforms in the executive compensation area. I think in the fall when they come back, they will clearly take up the financial services part of the consumer protection, CFPA, consumer Protection Financial Agency. And that has been a very controversial proposal. It was initially scheduled to be marked up in the House Financial Services Committee a few weeks ago, and Chairman Frank postponed it, publicly stating that wanted a open debate and wanted to give supporters of it more opportunity to get things lined up, their arguments lined up. And
Todd, could you give the listeners a sense of what a consumer financial protection agency is?
Oh, yeah, sure.
And why does the chairman feel that it's so necessary?
Well, there are a lot of people who do feel that it's necessary, mm-hmm. and then there are a lot who either don't feel it's necessary or think that the agency, as the proposal has come out, is too broad and overreaching. in the Reader's Digest version, it's an agency that would become the Uber regulator and protector of consumer products, from mortgages down to potentially payday and title lending. And there are a lot of, there are a number of participants who, in these various industries who may be unnecessarily swept up into a regulatory regime, for example, that could be overreaching because they're already being regulated effectively at the state level, and some previously have not been regulated at all at the federal level. And so it will be an entirely new regime that many feel is unnecessary. And then there's a concern about whether or not the separation of prudential regulatory authority with consumer protection, which this act would call for, because, again, we were talking about the Fed maybe taking on some of these responsibilities. There are many who are concerned that this may be inappropriate and that you need to have both housed in, with the same entity in order to effectively regulate the markets. And then there's a concern about what our regulatory scheme is going to do to our neighbors across the pond and in Asia, because everything that we do here will have a rippling effect on the global markets and not just our national markets.
Hmm. Very interesting.
They will take it up in the fall. It will remain to be controversial, so it's going to be, I think, very interesting to see what does come out of it, whether or not the proposal as it came over from the White House remains 50% intact, 70% intact, 90% intact, or what amendments and modifications will be made to it before it actually goes to the House floor.
Is reaction to the package of financial services reform falling down party lines, or are you seeing some cross-fertilization, if you will, of bipartisan support for the president's package?
Well, I think it's fair to say that the majority of Republicans are opposed to it, and then there are some Democrats who are opposed to it. You've got some of the progressives who don't think it goes far enough, some of the Blue Dogs, which are a conservative coalition in the Democratic caucus, who think it may go too far in some areas. So it's not a unified front right now on the Democratic side, which is one of the issues that their leadership is going to have to deal with in trying to get not only financial reform but health care passed, because there are similar schisms occurring on, I think, all of these issues.
Mm-hmm. You know, Todd, just taking a look at the landscape here in America, you see the public really, I mean, some very outspoken debates occurring across the country about health care. Do you predict you'll see the same type of outspoken debate as we turn our attention as a nation toward overhauling the financial services sector?
That is hard to say, but my instincts and my experience would say no, just because people do get upset, obviously, about, you know, pocketbook issues. But many of these regulatory reform proposals are kind of at the 30,000, 60,000-foot level, and while they will obviously impact everyday citizens eventually, it's not, I think, as clear a connection as healthcare is to their everyday lives. Grassroots efforts, I'm sure, will be involved in trying to gin up some of that support, but my feeling would be that the natural inclination of the masses to rise up, so to speak, in opposition or in support of the particular proposals is not there. I mean, something like executive compensation, for example, is something that hit the news a lot when you had what were perceived as outrageous sums of money being paid to executives of failing corporations or of corporations that were receiving federal assistance through the TARP funds or otherwise. And those make the headlines and people get upset about them, which is one of the reasons why legislation was introduced and considered in the House right before the recess. But that has started to die down, I think, in the public face. As you've probably seen, almost every news piece about members going home during the August recess has been about the health care debate, because that's the hottest and most contested right now. Clearly in the fall they will have to address all of these issues.
Well, I'm hearing the music again from the engineers that it's time for us to wrap up here.
Well, thanks for having me.
Todd, I wanted to thank you for coming on. We really enjoyed having you. Once again, your inside knowledge and your savvy sense of what's going on the Hill has really been informative for our listeners, and I hope to have you on again soon. Thank you so much, and thank you to everybody on behalf of Kevin O'Neill. This is Capital Thinking Radio, tuning out for this week, but back next week. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program, brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.